The Legacy. September 17, 1876, Aberdeen, Scotland. After Skaggs returned to England and a brief reunion with his wife and children, Carlyle and Dunhill offered him command of their newest and finest clipper ship, the Culloden, and sent him to engage in the China tea trade. After six more grueling voyages in which he set two records, Bully Skaggs retired to his cottage in Aberdeen, worn out at the early age of 47. The captains of clipper ships were men grown old before their time. The demands of sailing the world's fleetest ships took a heavy toll on body and spirit. Most died while still young. A great number went down with their ships. They were an elite breed, the famed iron men who drove wooden ships to unheard-of speeds during the most romantic era of the sea. They went to their graves, under grass or beneath the waves, knowing they had commanded the greatest sailing vessels ever built by man. Tough as the beams inside his ships, Skaggs was taking his last voyage at 59. Having built up a tidy nest egg by investing in owner's shares on his last four voyages, he was providing his children with a sizable fortune. Alone after the death of his beloved wife, Lucy, and his children grown with families of their own, he maintained his love for the sea by sailing in and around the firths of Scotland in a small ketch he'd built with his own hands. It was after a brief voyage through bitterly cold weather, to visit his son and grandchildren at Peterhead, that he took sick. A few days before he died, Skaggs sent for his longtime friend and former employer, Abner Carlyle. A respected shipping magnate, who built a sizable fortune with his partner, Alexander Dunhill, Carlyle was a leading resident of Aberdeen. Besides his shipping company, he also owned a mercantile business and a bank. His favorite charities were the local library and a hospital. Carlyle was a thin, wiry man, completely bald. He had kindly eyes and walked with a noticeable limp, caused by a fall off a horse when he was a young man. He was shown into Skaggs' house by the captain's daughter, Jenny, whom Carlyle had known since she was born. She embraced him briefly and took him by the hand. "Good of you to come, Abner. He's been asking for you every half hour. How is the old sea dog?" "I fear his days are numbered," she answered with a trace of sadness. Carlyle looked around the comfortable house filled with nautical furniture, the walls holding charts marked with daily runs during Skaggs' record voyages. "I'm going to miss this house. My brothers say it is best for the family if we sell it." She led Carlyle upstairs and through an open door into a bedroom with a large window that overlooked Aberdeen Harbor. "Father, Abner Carlyle is here."
"About time," Skaggs muttered grumpily.
Jenny gave Carlyle a peck on the cheek. "I'll go and make some tea." An old man, ravaged by three decades of a hard life at sea, lay unmoving on the bed. As bad as Skaggs looked, Carlyle couldn't help but marvel at the fire that still burned in those olive-gray eyes.
"I've got a new ship for you, Bully."
"The hell you say?" rasped Skaggs. "What's your rigging?"
"None. She's a steamer."
Skaggs' face turned red, and he raised his head.
"Goddamn stinkpots! They shouldn't be allowed to dirty up the seas."
It was the response Carlyle had hoped for. Bully Skaggs may have been at death's door, but he was going out as tough as he lived.
"Times have changed, my friend. Cutty Sark and Thermopylae are the only clippers you and I knew that are still working the seas."
"I don't have much time for idle chatter. I asked you to come to hear my deathbed confession and do me a personal favor."
Carlyle looked at Skaggs and said sarcastically,
"You thrash a drunk or bed a Chinese girl in a Shanghai brothel you never told me about?"
"I'm talking about the Gladiator," Skaggs muttered. "I lied about her."
"She sank in a typhoon," Carlyle said. "What was there to lie about?"
"She sank in a typhoon, all right. But the passengers and crew didn't go down to the bottom with her."
Carlyle was silent for several moments. Then he said carefully, "Charles Bully Skaggs, you're the most honest man I have ever known. In the half-century we've known each other, you've never betrayed a trust. Are you sure it isn't the sickness that's making you say crazy things? Trust me now when I say I've lived a lie for 20 years in repayment of a debt." Carlyle stared at him curiously. "What is it you wish to tell me?" "A story I've told no one." Skaggs leaned back on his pillow and stared beyond Carlyle, far into the distance at something only he could see. "The story of the raft of the Gladiator." Jenny returned half an hour later with tea. It was dusk, and she lit the oil lamps in the bedroom. "Father, you must try to eat something. I've made your favorite fish chowder."
"I've no appetite, daughter."
"Abner must be starved, listening to you all afternoon. I'll wager he'll eat something."
"Give us another hour," ordered Skaggs, "then make us eat what you will."
As soon as she was gone, Skaggs continued with the saga of the raft.
"When we finally got ashore, there were 8 of us left. Of the Gladiator's crew, only myself, Thomas Cochran, the ship's carpenter, and Alfred Reed, an able seaman, survived. Among the convicts, there was Jess Dorset, Betsy Fletcher, Marion Adams, George Pryor, and John Winkleman. 8 out of the 231 souls who set sail from England."
"You'll have to excuse me, dear old friend," said Carlyle, "if I appear skeptical. Scores of men murdering each other on a raft in the middle of the ocean, the survivors subsisting on human flesh, and then being saved from being devoured by a man-eating shark through the divine intervention of a sea serpent that kills the shark? An unbelievable tale, to say the least."
"You are not listening to the ravings of a dying man," Skaggs assured him weakly. "The account is true, every word of it."
Carlyle did not want to unduly upset Skaggs. The wealthy old merchant patted the arm of the sea captain, who in no small way had helped to build the shipping empire of Carlyle and Dunhill, and reassured him.
"Go on. I'm anxious to hear the ending. What happened after the 8 of you set foot on the island?"
For the next half hour, Skaggs told of how they drank their fill in a stream with sweet and pleasant water that ran from one of the small volcanic mountains. He described the large turtles that were caught in the lagoon, thrown on their backs and butchered with Dorset's knife, the only tool among them. Then, using a hard stone found at the water's edge and the knife as flint, they built a fire and cooked the turtle meat. 5 different kinds of fruit that Skaggs had never seen before were picked from trees in the forest. The vegetation seemed oddly different from the plants he'd seen in Australia. He recounted how the survivors passed the next few days gorging themselves until they regained their strength. "With our bodies on the mend, we set out to explore the island," Skaggs said, continuing his narration. "It was shaped like a fish hook, 5 miles in length and a little less than 1 wide. 2 massive volcanic peaks, each about 1,200 to 1,500 feet high, stood at the extreme ends. The lagoon measured about 3/4 of a mile long and was sheltered by a thick reef to seaward. The rest of the island was buttressed by high cliffs."
"Did you find it deserted?" asked Carlyle.
"Not a living soul did we see, nor animal, only birds. We saw signs that Aborigines had once inhabited the island, but it appeared they had been gone a long time."
"Any evidence of shipwrecks?"
"Not at that time."
"After the calamity on the raft, the island must have seemed like paradise," said Carlyle.
"She was the most beautiful island I've seen in my many years at sea," Skaggs agreed, referring to his place of refuge in the Feminine. "A magnificent emerald on a sapphire sea she was." He hesitated, as if envisioning the jewel rising out of the Pacific. "We soon settled into an idyllic way of life. I designated those to be in charge of certain services and appointed times for fishing, the construction and repair of shelter, the harvesting of fruit and other edibles.
and the maintenance of a constant fire for cooking, as well as to signal any ship that might pass by. In this manner we lived together in peace for several months. "I'm keen to guess," said Carlyle. "Trouble flared between the women." Skagg shook his head feebly. "More like among the men over the women." "So you experienced the same circumstances as the bounty mutineers on Pitcairn Island?" "Exactly. I knew there would soon be trouble, and I designed a schedule for the women to be divided equally among the men. Not a scheme to everybody's liking, of course, especially the women. But I knew of no other way to prevent bloodshed." "Under the circumstances, I would have to agree with you." "All I succeeded in doing was hastening the inevitable. The convict John Winkleman murdered able seaman Reed over Marion Adams, and Jess Dorset refused to share Betsy Fletcher with anyone. When George Pryor attempted to rape Fletcher, Dorset beat his brains in with a rock." "And then you were six?" Skaggs nodded. "Tranquility finally reigned on the island when John Winkleman married Marion Adams and Jess married Betsy." "Married?" Carlyle snorted in righteous indignation. "How was that possible?" "Have you forgotten, Abner?" Skaggs said, with a grin cracking his thin lips. "As a ship's captain, I was empowered to perform the ceremony." "By not actually standing on the deck of your ship, I must say you stretched matters a bit." "I have no regrets. We all lived in harmony until ship's carpenter Thomas Cochrane and I sailed away." "Did you and Cochrane not have desire for the women?" Skaggs' laughter turned into a brief coughing spell. Carlyle gave him a glass of water. When he recovered, Skaggs said, "Whenever my thoughts became carnal, I envisioned my sweet wife Lucy. I vowed to her that I would always return from a voyage as chaste as I left." "And the carpenter?" "Cochrane, as fate would have it, preferred the company of men." It was Carlyle's turn to laugh. "You picked a strange lot to share your adventures. Before long, we had built comfortable shelters out of rock and conquered boredom by constructing many ingenious devices to make our existence more enjoyable. Cochrane's carpentry skill became particularly useful once we found proper woodworking tools." "How did this come about?" "After about 14 months, a severe gale drove a French naval sloop onto the rocks at the southern end of the island. Despite our efforts to save them, the entire crew perished as the pounding of the breakers broke up their ship around them. When the seas calmed 2 days later, we recovered 14 bodies and buried them next to George Pryor and Alfred Reed. Then Dorset and I, who were the strongest swimmers, launched a diving operation to recover whatever objects from the wreck we might find useful. Within 3 weeks we had salvaged a small mountain of goods, materials, and tools. Cochrane and I now possessed the necessary implements to build a boat sturdy enough to carry us to Australia." "What of the women? How did Betsy and Marion fare?" queried Carlyle. Skaggs' eyes took on a sad look. "Poor Marion, she was kind and true, a modest servant girl who had been convicted of stealing food from her master's pantry. She died giving birth to a daughter. John Winkleman was horribly distraught. He went mad and tried to kill the baby. We tied him to a tree for 4 days until he finally got hold of his senses. But he was never quite the same again. He rarely spoke a word from that time until I left the island." "And Betsy?" "Cut from a different cloth, that one. Strong as a coal miner. She carried her weight with any man. Gave birth to 2 boys in as many years, as well as nursing Marion's child. Dorset and Betsy were devoted to each other." "Why didn't they come with you?" "Best they stayed on the island. I offered to plead for their release with the governor, but they didn't dare take the chance, and rightly so. As soon as they'd have landed in Australia, the penal constables would have grabbed the children and distributed them as orphans. Betsy's fate was probably to become a wool spinner in the filthy squalor of the female factory at Parramatta, while Jess was sure to end up in the convict barracks at Sydney. they'd likely never have seen their boys and each other again. I promised them that as long as I lived, they'd remain forgotten along with the lost souls of the gladiator.
And Winkleman, too?
Skaggs nodded.
He moved to a cave inside the mountain at the north end of the island and lived alone.
Carlyle sat silent and reflected on the remarkable story Skaggs had related.
All these years you've never revealed their existence.
I found out later that if I had broken my promise to remain silent, that bastard of a governor in New South Wales would have sent a ship to get them. He had a reputation for moving hell to regain an escaped prisoner.
Skaggs moved his head slightly and stared through the window at the ships in the harbor.
After I returned home, I saw no reason to tell the story of the gladiator's raft.
You never saw them again after you and Cochrane set sail for Sydney?
Skaggs shook his head.
A tearful goodbye it was, too, Betsy and Jess standing on the beach holding their baby boys and Marion's daughter, looking for all the world like a happy mother and father. They found a life that wasn't possible in the civilized world.
He spat out the word civilized.
And Cochrane, what was to stop him from speaking out?
Skaggs' eyes glimmered faintly.
As I mentioned, he also had a secret he didn't want known. Certainly not if he ever wished to go to sea again. He went down with the Zanzibar when she was lost in the South China Sea back in 67.
Haven't you ever wondered how they made out?
No need to wonder, Skaggs replied slyly.
I know.
Carlyle's eyebrows raised.
I'd be grateful for an explanation.
4 years after I departed, an American whaler sighted the island and stood in to fill her water casks. Jess and Betsy met the crew and traded fruits and fresh fish for cloth and cooking pots. They told the captain of the whaler that they were missionaries who were stranded on the island after their ship had been wrecked. Before long, other whalers began stopping by for water and food supplies. One of the ships traded Betsy's seeds for hats she'd woven out of palms, and she and Jess began tilling several acres of arable land for vegetables.
How do you know all this?
They began sending out letters with the whalers.
They're still alive? Asked Carlyle, his interest aroused.
Skaggs' eyes saddened. Jess died while fishing 6 years ago. A sudden squall capsized his boat. Betsy said it looked as if he struck his head and drowned. Her last letter, along with a packet, arrived only 2 days ago. You'll find it in the center drawer of my desk. She wrote that she was dying from some sort of disease of the stomach.
Carlyle rose and crossed the bedroom to a worn captain's desk that Skaggs had used on all his voyages after the gladiator went down. He pulled a small packet wrapped in oilskin from the drawer and opened it. Inside he found a leather pouch and a folded letter. He returned to his chair, slipped on his reading glasses, and glanced at the words.
For a girl convicted of theft, she writes very well.
Her earlier letters were full of misspellings, but Jess was an educated man, and under his tutelage Betsy's grammar showed great improvement.
Carlyle began reading aloud.
My dear Captain Skaggs, I pray you are in good health. This will be my last letter to you, as I have a malady of the stomach, or so the doctor aboard the whaling ship Amy and Jason tells me. So I will soon be joining my Jess. I have a last request that I pray you will honor. In the first week of April of this year, my two sons and Marion's daughter Mary departed the island on board a whaler, whose captain was sailing from here to Auckland for badly needed repairs to his hull after a brush with a coral reef. There the children were to book passage on a ship bound for England, and then eventually make their way to you in Aberdeen. I have written to ask you, dearest friend, to take them under your roof upon their arrival and arrange for their education at the finest schools England has to offer. I would be eternally grateful, and I know Jess would share the same sentiments. Rest his dear departed soul, if you will honor my request.
I have included my legacy for your services and whatever cost it takes to see them through school. They are very bright children and will be diligent in their studies. With deepest regret, I wish you a loving farewell. Betsy Dorset. One final thought. The serpent sends his regards. Carlyle peered over his glasses. The serpent sends his regards? What nonsense is that? The sea serpent, who saved us from the great white shark, answered Skaggs. Turned out he lived in the lagoon. I saw him with my own eyes on at least four other occasions during my time on the island. Carlyle looked at his old friend as if he were drunk, then thought better of pursuing the matter. She sent young children alone on a long voyage from New Zealand to England? Not so young, said Skaggs. The oldest must be going on 19. If they left the island the early part of April, they may come knocking on your door at any time. Providing they did not have to wait long in Auckland to find a stout ship that made a fast passage. My God, man, you're in an impossible situation. What you really mean is, how can a dying man carry out an old friend's dying wish? You're not going to die, said Carlyle, looking Skaggs in the eye. Oh, yes, I am, Skaggs said firmly. You're a practical businessman, Abner. Nobody knows that better than me. That's why I ask to see you before I take my final voyage. You want me to wet-nurse Betsy's children? They can live in my house until you drop their anchor in the best educational institutions money can buy. The pitiful amount that Betsy made selling hats and food supplies to visiting whaling ships won't come close to covering the cost of several years of boarding at expensive schools. They'll need the proper clothes and private tutors to bring them up to proper learning levels. I hope you're not asking me to provide for total strangers. Skaggs pointed to the leather pouch. Carlyle held it up. Is this what Betsy sent you to educate her children? Skaggs nodded slightly. Open it. Carlyle loosened the strings and poured the contents into his hand. He looked up at Skaggs incredulously. Is this some sort of a joke? These are nothing but ordinary stones. Trust me, Abner, they are not ordinary. Carlyle held up one about the size of a prune in front of his spectacles and peered at it. The surface of the stone was smooth, and its shape was octahedral, having eight sides. This is nothing but some sort of crystal. It's absolutely worthless. Take the stones to Levi Strausser. The Jewish gem merchant. Show the stones to him. Precious gems they're not, said Carlyle firmly. Please. Skaggs barely got the word out. The long conversation had tired him. As you wish, old friend. He pulled out his pocket watch and looked at the time. I'll call on Strausser first thing in the morning and return to you with his appraisal. Thank you, Skaggs murmured. The rest will take care of itself. Carlyle walked under an early morning drizzle to the old business district near Castlegate. He checked the address and turned up the steps to one of the many inconspicuous grey houses built of local granite that gave the city of Aberdeen a solid, if drab, appearance. Small brass letters mounted beside the door read, simply, Strausser and Sons. He pulled the bell knob and was shown into a Spartan furnished office by a clerk, offered a chair and a cup of tea. A slow minute passed before a short man in a long frock coat, a salt-and-pepper beard down to his chest, entered through a side door. He smiled politely and extended his hand. I am Levi Strausser. What service can I perform for you? My name is Abner Carlyle. I was sent by my friend Captain Charles Skaggs. Captain Skaggs sent a messenger who announced your coming. I am honored to have Aberdeen's most renowned merchant in my humble office. Have we ever met? We don't exactly travel in the same social circles, and you are not the kind of man who buys jewelry. My wife died young, and I never remarried. so there was no reason to purchase expensive baubles. I too lost a wife at an early age, but I was fortunate enough to find a lovely woman who bore me 4 sons and 2 daughters. Carlyle had often done business with Jewish merchants over the years, but he had never had dealings in gemstones. He was on unfamiliar ground and felt uncomfortable with Strausser. He took out the leather pouch and laid it on the desk. "Captain Skaggs requested your appraisal of the stones inside." Strausser laid a sheet of white paper at the desk top and poured the contents of the pouch in a pile in the center. He counted the stones. There were 18. He took his time and carefully scrutinized each one through his loupe, a small magnifier used by jewelers. Finally, he held up the largest and the smallest stones, one in each hand. "If you will kindly be patient, Mr. Carlyle, I would like to conduct some tests on these 2 stones. I'll have one of my sons serve you another cup of tea." "Yes, thank you. I don't mind waiting." Nearly an hour passed before Strausser returned to the room with the 2 stones. Carlyle was a shrewd observer of men. He had to be to have successfully negotiated over 1,000 business ventures since he purchased his first ship at the tender age of 22. He saw that Levi Strausser was nervous. There were no obvious signs, no shaking hands, little ticks around the mouth, beads of sweat. It was there in the eyes. Strausser looked like a man who had beheld God. "May I ask where these stones came from?" Strausser asked. "I cannot tell you the exact location," Carlyle answered honestly. "The mines of India are played out, and nothing like this has come out of Brazil. Perhaps one of the new diggings in South Africa?" "It is not for me to say. Why, is there a value to the stones?" "You do not know what they are?" Strausser asked in astonishment. "I am not an expert in minerals. My business is shipping." Strausser held out his hands over the stones like an ancient sorcerer. "Mr. Carlyle, these are diamonds, the finest uncut stones I have ever seen." Carlyle covered his amazement nobly. "I don't question your integrity, Mr. Strausser, but I can't believe you are serious." "My family has dealt in precious stones for 5 generations, Mr. Carlyle. Believe me when I say you have a fortune lying on the desk. Not only do they have indications of perfect transparency and clearness, but they possess an exquisite and very extraordinary violet rose color. Because of their beauty and rarity, they command a higher price than the perfect colorless stones." Carlyle came back on keel and cut away the cobwebs. "What are they worth?" "Rough stones are almost impossible to classify for value, since their true qualities do not become apparent until they are cut and faceted, to enhance the maximum optical effect, and polished. The smallest you have here weighs 60 carats in the rough." He paused to hold up the largest specimen. "This one weighs out at over 980 carats, making it the largest known uncut diamond in the world. I judge that it might be a wise investment to have them cut before I sell them. Or, if you prefer, I could offer you a fair price in the rough." Carlyle began to place the stones back in the leather pouch. "No, thank you. I represent a dying friend. It is my duty to provide him with the highest profit possible." Strausser quickly realized that the canny Scotsman could not be influenced to part with the uncut stones. The opportunity to obtain the diamonds for himself, have them faceted, and then sell them on the London market for an immense gain, was not in the cards. Better to make a good profit than none at all, he decided wisely. "You need not go any farther than this office, Mr. Carlyle. 2 of my sons apprenticed at the finest diamond cutting house in Antwerp. They are as good, if not better, than any cutters in London. Once the stones are faceted and polished, I can act as your broker, should you then wish to sell." "Why should I not sell them on my own?" "For the same reason, I would come to you to ship goods to Australia, instead of buying a ship and transporting them myself. I am a member of the London Diamond Exchange. You are not. I can demand and receive 2x the price you might expect."
Carlyle was shrewd enough to appreciate a sound business offer when he heard one. He came to his feet and offered Strausser his hand. "I place the stones in your capable hands, Mr. Strausser. I trust it will prove to be a profitable arrangement for you and the people I represent." "You can bank on it, Mr. Carlyle." As the Scots shipping magnate was about to step from the office, he turned and looked back at the Jewish precious stone dealer. "After your sons are finished with the stones, what do you think they will be worth?" Strausser stared down at the ordinary-looking stones, visualizing them as sparkling crystals. "If these stones came from an unlimited source that can be easily exploited, the owners are about to launch an empire of extraordinary wealth. If you will forgive me for saying so, your appraisal sounds a bit fanciful." Strausser looked across the desk at Carlyle and smiled. "Trust me when I say these stones, when cut and faceted, could sell in the neighborhood of £1,000,000.
"Good God," Carlyle blurted, "that much?"
Strausser lifted the huge 980-carat stone to the light, holding it between his fingers as if it were the Holy Grail. When he spoke, it was in a voice of adoring reverence.
"Perhaps even more. Much more."